American politics may never be the same. On To The Point, we help you understand the trends driving this wild and woolly election.
Usually we don't have a presidential election in which the sanity of a major party candidate is really openly in question.
She's not the greatest politician. She says so herself.
She colors within the lines of American politics.
Does the Democratic Party need a reform? Absolutely.
I'm Armin Alney. Stay with To The Point through November and beyond on KCRW and KCRW.com.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
FBI Director James Comey dropped a bomb on the election, saying they have new emails that may be pertinent to the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server. Hacked emails from Clinton operatives are raising new concerns about the Clinton Foundation and are also telling us something interesting about who's influential within Clinton's orbit. And some Republicans are saying they might keep blocking new Supreme Court appointments even after the election. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jon Favreau, former speechwriter for President Obama and co-host of the podcast Keeping It 1600. Our special guest is Emily Bazelon, senior research fellow at Yale Law School and a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Welcome, everybody. On Friday afternoon, FBI Director James Comey sent a letter to various congressional committee chairmen saying the FBI is looking into new emails it has found related to Hillary Clinton's private email server. Comey's letter says that in the course of an unrelated investigation, the FBI discovered additional emails that appear to be pertinent to the Clinton investigation that had been closed earlier this year. So, for a little behind the scenes, we tape our show around 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern on Fridays. So, the conversation you're about to hear was recorded before we learned that the emails were discovered on a computer jointly used by Clinton's top aide, Huma Abedin, and her husband, Anthony Weiner. As you may recall, the FBI is investigating inappropriate text messages that Weiner sent to a 15-year-old girl, and now that investigation has bled into the email conversation because apparently this campaign was not stupid enough. As you'll hear, the conversation that we recorded a few hours ago remains timely. The FBI has not yet reviewed the emails as to whether they contain classified information, but will do so. Obviously, this Friday afternoon news has rocked the campaign, and it's also rocked the financial markets. The Dow Jones Index dropped 0.5% in the minutes after the FBI letter came out. Mexican peso also crashed, indicating some thought that there's a significant effect on the election here. Election prediction markets actually moved about 8 points against Hillary Clinton, though they still show her with a 75% chance to win the election. So I need a drink. So first of all, I don't know what to make of this letter, which is written in this vague Washington bureaucratese. We don't know what these emails are, where they came from, whether they contain important information or not, when the FBI will say anything about that. And so at various times during the campaign, we've had both campaigns and their surrogates raging against FBI Director James Comey, convinced that he is a biased operator, although from those accusations, it's unclear in which direction he would be biased. And I look at him and I look at the way that Donald Trump has been attacking James Comey over the last few months. And I can't imagine that James Comey is sitting at FBI headquarters thinking to himself, how can I get Donald Trump elected president? So I think there has to be some other explanation for this letter. So why today? Why this letter?
Yeah. I have no idea. and as you say, it's even unclear what the letter means. It refers repeatedly to an investigation without specifying whether it's an investigation into an unrelated case he alludes to at the beginning, or whether it's the email investigation itself. And it's hard to see how just the surfacing of new, perhaps classified emails would change the FBI's determination in the email case at all, because Comey's explanation for how they came down would really withstand, I think, any new evidence, which is basically there was no intent there, and it would be unprecedented and really borderline unconstitutional for us to recommend prosecution of a case if there's not intent. So it's very hard to figure, but it could, you know, have an effect here, because the worst moments of Hillary's had in the campaign, one, the fall, and two, Comey's kind of excoriating 15-minute explanation of why they weren't going to prosecute her, and then the release of subsequent FBI documents related to the investigation. So this could hurt her.
Why be specific in a letter when you're the nation's top law enforcement officer in an election where the Republic hangs in the balance, right? Like, I cannot imagine that you would put out a letter that vague and with that much government speak in it when he's smart enough to know what it was going to do. Now, I don't think he's partisan one way or the other. I think he's been he's a government official who's trying to just sort of follow the law here, but I don't think the FBI has sort of put enough thought into what this would do. I mean, I was saying he at least owes the country a press conference, a press briefing, even if he doesn't take questions, just to explain a little more. I mean, there's just, it's 10, 11 days before the election. If something might be wrong, he needs to tell people one way or the other. You know, people are voting and everyone's going to speculate about this completely irresponsibly, which is already happening. And so that, you know, could have an effect.
Emily, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I tended to defend Comey here, partly just to be contrarian, maybe. But look, he was conducting an investigation. He told Congress it was closed. They got some new information, and they're reviewing it. I mean, until they review it and read it and decide whether it's classified, which presumably is something that they don't do in 10 minutes, what else could he say? I mean, unless there's some additional grain of information here that he's withholding. And it seems like he's trying to be as transparent as possible. And if he had not sent this letter and, you know, the fact that he had this information then seemed like something he was withholding before the election, that could also seem problematic.
My initial reaction to this has actually been to be quite angry with Hillary Clinton, because we saw earlier on in the FBI investigation, you know, they turned over all these emails. They turned over the emails that they said were related to work. And then it turned out later that the way that they had searched through this massive number of emails in her server, which were both professional and private emails, was that they used keywords. They looked based on which senders and recipients were on the emails. And based on those searches, they turned over the ones that those turned up. And then it turned out, as the FBI did its forensic investigation of her server, they sort of kept finding additional emails that hadn't been turned over because that search was under-inclusive. So it looks to me like this is another round of that. I don't know where these additional emails came from, but it seems like one obvious candidate for a place would be the hacked emails from John Podesta that have been released. The FBI said that the emails were found in an unrelated investigation. It would make sense that there would be an FBI investigation into how Podesta's email account got hacked. And all I can think of looking at this is that if Hillary had been forthcoming all along, if she either hadn't done this private server nonsense, or if she had properly maintained and released the records in accordance with Freedom of Information Act requests and other reasons that people had reason to see these emails, we wouldn't be here today. This story would be over. It's been her instinct for secrecy that has brought us to this place. And I'm just mad that the fate of the Republic hangs in the balance, and she's up against this obviously unacceptable person. And she's done this thing that, you know, I look at it, and however bad this is, it's not as bad as what Donald Trump has done and might do, but she's endangered her own chances to win this election, which is important not just for her, but for the country. And I'm really angry about that.
Well, one of the things that's been remarkable about the Podesta emails, the latest batch, is we've seen that privately they were kind of all thinking what everyone was saying publicly about the email scandal, especially the critics. What were they thinking? Who gave her permission to do this? Why won't she just come clean? Why won't she apologize? And I think the most telling comment in all those emails was from Neera Tanden. I guess they just thought they could get away with it. And that's clearly what they did think.
But we don't know what the new emails are. We don't know if they came from a result of her deleting anything or her not finding them or her fault. I mean, we're in such a fast information age right now that, I mean, there's going to be, between now and Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, there's going to be so much unbelievable speculation about what this might be and leading us to all kinds of places, whether it's blaming Hillary, whether it's blaming Comey, whatever it may be. And we kind of just have to wait, you know?
No, don't say that, John. Please. You're killing us.
I know, but it's just, I don't know. Yeah, no, of course she made a mistake. And then she said she was sorry about the mistake, and she did. She shouldn't have done this, but like,
she made a series of mistakes.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the...
But she did that a long time ago and said she's sorry, and now we're just dealing with the... You're right, now we're dealing with the drip, drip, drip of it.
And what do we really care about here? Do we care about whether she actually released classified information and handled these emails irresponsibly? Do we care about, are we still litigating whether she set the server up in an intent to get around the law, which, you know, supposedly that part the FBI did decide was resolved? Like, what's really at stake here at this point?
Yeah, no, we're mad that she created a political problem for herself is what we're mad at right now.
Right, you know? No, I
which,
get
no,
the,
no, but that's what I'm saying. That's what's so
point.
Silly about it.
But
you know?
She,
like,
no, she clearly set it up to evade federal record laws and FOIA requests. You know what James Carville said right at the outset? Oh, she did it because she didn't want congressional investigators to see her emails. That's why she did it. It was for the purpose of secrecy and to keep potentially embarrassing information that the public had a right to know away from the public. And that's just frankly wrong. And she's paid a price from it from the time of the that it was first revealed. And she continues to pay a price for it because she never came clean or cleaned it up, as Josh pointed out.
And what I'm upset about is
she did express regret for it. So she did, right, she did try to deal with it. Maybe you think inadequately. But I still feel like what we've litigated all of that, right, extensively.
Right.
And so without knowing anything about the content of these emails or what they're related to or where they come from, what do we actually have here
but she's
to
never,
talk about other than a big question mark?
Right.
That, you
right.
know, an apology was dragged out of her. And as Niren Tanden pointed out in one of those emails, she's sort of, you know, she's tiptoeing up to it and she'll eventually get pushed into it. And she did get pushed into it. But she's never, frankly, acknowledged why she did this. You know, she said for convenience
no,
and all sorts
did.
Of reasons.
No, she did. She gave an
it
explanation.
It was to keep it
you
secret.
You might not buy it. Yeah, she, no, she talked
yeah,
about
I don't
her
buy
privacy
it.
And her
it's
convenience.
Completely
that's
implausible.
Fine. But we already, but again, like, we've already had this argument 10 times.
Right. So,
we?
Yeah,
if
we
want an election,
if
you
we
don't just
say,
get to decide the public shouldn't care
okay.
about something it
if
cares
we want,
about.
If
it
we
does.
Want to say she shouldn't be president now, 10 days out, because she still hasn't said that she did it to evade FOIA, but she did it because out of convenience, then we can talk about that. But that has nothing to do with the news that broke today. Zero.
No, but it's what I wanted was not an apology. What I want is an adjustment in her attitude toward appearances of improper behavior, appearances of conflict of interest. I view it as part of a much broader pattern going back decades with Bill and Hillary Clinton, with their view basically being, if we can get away with it, we can go
right.
ahead
and
do it.
That's sure. never going to change.
Sure. I think there is some evidence in the Podesta hack that it had changed at least somewhat, or at least that people within her orbit, people like Neera Tanden, who called the server setup insane, people like John Podesta, people who have better judgment about this stuff, have been gaining influence in her circle. And some of the worst influences within her circle, people like Sid Blumenthal, people like Doug Band, who wrote this long memo about the ways the Clinton Foundation and Teneo Group and all the various parts of Clinton world were working together to make money for Bill Clinton and to have synergy with each other that would raise questions about how they are using influence across these platforms. Those people were being pushed out. So I think there actually have been hopeful signs in here that Hillary Clinton is finally learning about the cost of behaving like this. But the problem was that politically, it came too late because of the release of all this prior stuff.
But also, even if she's made some pivot now and is going to be purer than Caesar's wife, there is scattered throughout this all the emails and all the Clinton Foundation dealings, years worth of embarrassing information that they'll have to try to hide, that they'll have to do partisan warfare with Republican investigators. This whole MO and the whole pattern is going to stretch into a Clinton administration if she's president. There's no doubt about it.
We have to take a break. Let us know what you think about this mess at kcrw.com/LRC or on our Facebook page. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Jon Favreau, former speechwriter for President Obama. And Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine is our special guest. So we'll turn to the Supreme Court in a moment. I want to talk a little bit more about that memo that I had mentioned, the Doug Band memo regarding the Clinton Foundation. One thing that's gotten a lot of attention this week has been emails from the John Podesta hack about the operations of the Clinton Foundation. Emily, I want to get you in on this first. Do you think that there is anything to the critiques that basically the foundation, while doing a lot of excellent philanthropic work, was also being used in some inappropriate way as an influence vehicle for the Clintons?
Well, what does inappropriate mean here? I mean, is in an ideal world, would they not be doing all of these things at the same time? Yes, I think that is pretty clear. Is there any evidence of, you know, someone getting some valuable, tangible favor from the State Department because they gave money to the Clinton Foundation? I think we have yet to see that. So again, it's this question of how much do we hold against Hillary Clinton, that there is this kind of secretive, you know, entitled way that the Clintons sometimes conduct their business. And I also object to that. And yet, when you look for like the actual smoking gun here, I feel like we don't have it. It's not there. And then, you know, as one of you raised earlier, of course, she's running for president against Donald Trump. And here we are only talking about her and these questions about her ethics or what's appropriate as opposed to all the evidence we have about him in this area.
I would note that we have been fairly Trump obsessive on this show over
I'm
the
sure
over the
you
last.
Have.
Everyone has been. The entire media
How
has
could you
been.
Resist? Totally. Yeah. No, I get that, but you know, we're whatever we are, 10 days out, 11 days out from the election, and these questions about Clinton and the Clinton Foundation are front and center again.
I guess the question then is if the you know we have no evidence of a smoking gun of somebody getting something of value from the Clintons' official capacities as a result of donations to the Clinton Foundation or speaking fees or payments to Teneo Group or any of that. But I guess my question then is, you know, these wealthy people who were giving money, now some of them obviously are motivated by true philanthropic ends, but I have to believe that a lot of them thought they were getting valuable access from this. So I guess is the idea, the good case for the Clinton Foundation, basically that the Clintons were running a con of sorts on their wealthy donors, convincing them they were buying access they weren't getting? Because there were these emails between Huma Abedin supporting Hillary Clinton at the State Department and Doug Band, then at the Clinton Foundation, trying to set up calls, you know, for people who wanted to talk to people in the State Department. And it seemed actually pretty clear that none of those calls had resulted in anything of value for the people. But it seemed also like the people who had given the money to the Clinton Foundation were doing that in part because they thought they would be able to get Doug Band to harass people inside the State Department.
Yeah, there's a line in one
of
these.
Is that a con? Or is that just like they're trying to, you know, of course, the people who are trying to give money might think there's an opening for influence. And then they knock on the door and it stays shut. And eventually you would imagine that that kind of assumption would go away.
These people wanted to sit on stage with Bill Clinton at CGI and get meetings with them and rub shoulders with them because they like being known and they like being prominent. And Bill Clinton likes that too. He likes rubbing elbows with all these people. He needs that. And so he was going to make a ton of money from speeches anyway. And so then he was like, okay, well, I want to give some of the, you better give some of this money to the foundation too, so we can do some good work. And like, it was all, my thing is, it's all on the Bill Clinton side, right? And like, I hope Doug Band never goes near the White House when Hillary right. Clinton is president, right? And he shouldn't. And a lot of those people on the Bill Clinton side, you know, it's the same thing. But it, for me, it does. It all goes back to like, what policy decision was made at the State Department that had any kind of direct link to anything that happened with speeches, with the Clinton Foundation, with the donors, with anyone else? And I haven't seen anything yet.
Well, I'd say a couple things. One, the idea that this was a con on the donors, I might be willing to accept that argument if no one else was getting rich off the deal, which both Bill Clinton and Doug Band and his business were. And clearly, you're a rich donor. There are lots of ways to do good works. There's the Red Cross. There's UNICEF. And a lot of these people, not all, but a lot of them were attracted to the Clinton Foundation and the global initiative because they thought it would give them additional access. And no, we haven't seen a quid pro quo from the State Department, but we have seen email exchanges saying, this guy is important because he gives money to the foundation. Please help me. And Huma actually saying, let me see what I can do.
Well, I do want to move on and talk about the Supreme Court, because as it seemed to become increasingly clear that Hillary Clinton will win this election, and for the next few minutes, we'll work within that assumption, and those prediction markets that dived a little bit are still showing her at like a 75% chance of winning. Republicans started talking about what they'll do about the Supreme Court if she wins and this seat they've been holding open for a year will not have a Republican president to fill it. Ted Cruz noted that the court seems to work just fine with fewer than 9 justices, and John McCain assured supporters that Republicans would block whoever Hillary Clinton nominated, later modifying his comments to say the more careful thing he probably meant to say, which was that he would evaluate any nominee on the merits, but that he doesn't expect her nominees to have good merits. Emily, this obviously would take us into an unprecedented place with a court seat being held open for over a year. But as I look back, it's been decades that we've had extremely contentious Supreme Court nomination fights whenever the Senate and the presidency are in opposing hands. So is this sort of the logical end of what started maybe with the Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas hearings, where as parties became more and more resistant to allowing someone they disagree with on the court, that they would ultimately decide they just wouldn't fill seats at all?
It's not the logical end, but it is unfortunately a possible end. I mean, let's think about what we're talking about here. We're talking about the possibility that unless one party controls the Senate and the presidency, there will be no Supreme Court justice who gets through a nomination. And so, yeah, now we have eight people. Well, we could have seven people or six people. And it's one thing to think that for a year or a year and a half, the Supreme Court can function in this kind of incomplete way. It's another thing to imagine the court going on this way in a kind of semi-permanent sense, because they're totally ducking. And we already had 4-4 splits in important matters last year, in particular President Obama's effort to extend deportation relief to 4 or 5 million immigrants. So, you know, the Supreme Court does have a role to play in American life, and especially when there's a tie vote, it's not really functional.
John, what would you want Democrats to do if they had a Senate majority against a Republican president? What sort of nominee should they confirm?
If the Democrats had a majority and it was a Republican president. I mean, look,
yes.
I would not want the party to get away with saying we're only going to have eight justices. We're only going to allow eight justices on the court. Sorry, that's our Democratic position. I don't think that's the morally right thing to do, but I also think that's politically ridiculous. Like, if the Republicans want to close out this election with a message of, like, vote for us and we'll give you a dysfunctional Supreme Court and years of investigations, that's our promise for our closing argument, then, like, go for it. I mean, there's a reason that someone smart in John McCain's world made him walk back that statement after he gave it, you know, because I just don't think it's not a tenable political position for a party to have. That's not to say that they won't stick with it, because they don't seem to think otherwise.
Is there any sign that
political price for taking that position, right? I mean, it's actually been pretty smart from their point of view,
right,
so far, because Merrick Garland has been dangling out there and it's not been a major issue in the election.
Yeah, I've seen no evidence that this matters at all in Senate races. I don't see any penalty that Republican Senate nominees are paying for refusing to confirm him. And in fact, I suspect that it's been helping to energize their own supporters. A lot of, given the justifications that we're hearing for skeptical Republicans voting for Donald Trump, the idea of ensuring that liberals do not get put on the court seems to be a motivating factor for Republican voters.
Absolutely. So it'll show up in polls. You know, polls, people say they want a confirmation vote, but this is a classic intensity issue where all the intensity is on the side of Republicans who want to block Garland. And look, Cruz is right as a technical matter, but politically it would become unsustainable. And if Republicans don't have a majority, it's all really moot, because even if they try to filibuster, Chuck Schumer would, in very short order, just end the filibuster.
But so what if Republicans do have a majority? Do you think it's fine for them to just keep holding the seat open?
I would, if I were in the Senate, I would, and this would be tricky because, you know, nominees always say they won't discuss specific cases, but I wouldn't confirm anyone that had any inkling would bless those executive orders on immigration, which I think are really a grave offense against separation of powers and against the legislative branch. So if I'm in the Senate, it's my job to defend my chamber and its prerogatives, and I wouldn't go along with any effort to really invalidate them in that way.
So I guess then the question I have, if the alternative in these split cases where the Senate's in one party's hands, the presidency in the other, rather than just blocking all the nominees, you could try to have compromises where you try to come up with nominees who are somewhere close to the political center, the ideological center, that would be acceptable enough to both sides.
Like when Merrick Garland?
Well, but that's the question. Merrick Garland
is... You can't get someone more acceptable to both sides than Merrick Garland. This is ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Orrin Hatch loved him until he was nominated for the Supreme Court.
He'll be a pretty down-the-line liberal vote, but if Hillary were to renominate him, I think at least enough Republicans would go along. But this is the way the Constitution is set up. It's all a political process, and if Republicans want to say, you know what, it's fine to have just eight justices on the court, then there's nothing to make them move except paying a political price for it. So you have an argument about it, and the public ultimately gets to decide.
I think there's actually a certain amount of judicial polarization where there's a lot of space between Merrick Garland and and John Roberts. And it's hard to think of a lot of examples of judges that sit in that ideological space. I mean, Anthony Kennedy is an example. Richard Posner, I guess, would be an example, although he's too old to be nominated to the court. But I don't know, Emily, is there a cohort of truly centrist judges somewhere in between Garland and Roberts that would be available to nominate if that were the norm?
I don't think so, and I don't actually think either Kennedy or Posner are good examples. Look, what do judges, first of all, judges are nominated by a president who comes from either the Republican or the Democratic Party, right? So there is inherent in the system a politicization of their role. Then they get on the bench. What do? They make decisions. And so they have to come down on one side of the other of different issues. And there are some judges that don't always go in the kind of expected ideological direction. But that is supposed to be based on the facts of the case before them and how careful they are about applying the law. Because on the lower courts, that's what you do. You apply law. You don't make it. You get to the Supreme Court, you're making a lot of law. And so, someone like Merrick Garland, Rich may be right that he will be a down-the-line liberal vote when he gets to the court. But on the D.C. Circuit, he has been really a very cautious kind of incrementalist judge. I don't know where else you go. I mean, unless you're going to argue that a Democratic president should nominate a Republican nominated judge.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Jon Favreau, what's your rant?
Well, this is going to be especially good today since everyone's freaking out. But look, there's going to be a lot of attention paid to all the tracking polls in the last 10 days. I would advise people to stop freaking out. I was just looking, at this point in 2012, the ABC Washington Post tracking poll had us down 3 points, 50-47 against Romney. We ended up winning by 51-48 10 days later. The race did not swing 6 points in 1 week. Races do not swing by that big of margin that are baked in and after this long, and most voters' preferences are set. So whatever side you're on, when you're thinking about freaking about polls, just go do some work instead of worrying about that.
So you think the FBI news has zero effect on the fundamentals in the race?
No. No, I think we'll probably, I think it could, with based on the coverage we're going to get over the next couple of days of speculation, I think the speculation alone could cause a little tightening over the next week. If it's something really bad and serious and Comey comes out, and yeah, that of course could change it. But if it's just this speculation, then I don't think it changes the fundamentals.
Rich Lowry.
In Canada, a woman made it her business to give thirsty pigs water when they were on trucks on the way to slaughter, and now has been charged with the crime, with criminal mischief. It's a fascinating case in part because it really brings to the fore how arbitrary we are and how we decide which animals we feel compelled to treat humanely and which we don't.
Emily Bazelon.
There is a man named Adam Crasper in Washington State who is about to be deported, even though he was adopted from South Korea when he was 3 and he's lived in the country his entire life. He's 41. This is because his adoptive parents didn't put through his citizenship papers and he committed some crimes. And it just raises a question, which actually the Supreme Court is also going to review right after the election, about people who spend their entire lives in this country and then for one technical reason or another don't have the right to stay here. Do we really send them back to a place that they have no ties to?
For my rant, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, who you may recall from a few weeks ago saying, "I'm out," and that he can't support Donald Trump anymore, has now come around and says that he will vote for Donald Trump because Hillary Clinton is just that bad. He also said that they have enough material for 2 years of investigations into Hillary Clinton after she should win an election. I'm exhausted. You're exhausted. We're all exhausted. It's going to still be incredibly exhausting even after November 9th. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Jon Favreau, and Emily Bazelon. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Berskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.